Nice to be back here. I was yesterday I went to the Great Stupa of Bendigo, so I've been teaching here and there. I don't know how much teaching yesterday I did. I just did some chanting yesterday, but we had the last Vaisak ceremony pretty much yesterday. This was my third Vaisak this year, so we monks, we tend to go from Vaisak to Vaisak. I'm sure many of you probably came to Nupri. We have that sort of two Vaisaks. Ajahn Brahm was the second. Beautiful, beautiful ceremony. It's very uplifting when you see Ajahn Brahm for after a while. And it was a beautiful day, and it was in many ways, it was very uplifting. A lot of people told that it was such a nice, beautiful reminder when somebody like Ajahn Brahm comes to the monastery and teaches the people. He just the way he gives speeches, he's always very inspiring. So, and then a few days later, I got a message from somebody saying that I was so uplifted on that day. Now, effect lasted like 2 days. I think that's what happens. Very normal, isn't it? You go on, you get inspired on something, and the effect lasts for a few days. And I'm not any different from that. The same thing. Like, it's very beautiful to stay with Ajahn Brahm. He was in the monastery for a few days, and it almost feels like it's very inspiring. I was going to say it's almost like a holiday somewhere, beautiful place, but it's different. No, it's very different when you see somebody you respect a lot, and somebody you look up to, and there's just this feeling of easiness when you're with Ajahn Brahm, for example. And I always remember Ajahn has been my teacher since early days, early on my starting to meditate and all that. But even then, I sometimes remember my first teachers when I started to meditate. They always remind me of having a gratitude. There's something to that. And I hope maybe I can, somebody will someday come to me and say, you were my first teacher. So far it hasn't happened, but maybe some point. But anyways, I don't mind coming to here. You know, Paul was kind enough to drive me. It's a bit of a hike coming from Nupri here, but I mean, it uplifts my mind, and hopefully uplifts you for next 2 days, or today until afternoon. I don't know. 2 o'clock tonight, today, you feel like depressed. So I didn't really know what I'm going to start talking about today. I thought this morning that I would have a topic in my mind. So last night I went to sleep, and because I knew I was going to come here yesterday, and I was like, oh, tomorrow morning, mind, can you have a topic to talk about today? This morning I woke up, I was like, blank, nothing. So I actually, as always, I don't prepare. I come from the tradition of not preparing too much for these talks, and I've asked Ajahn Brahm a couple of times, should I prepare for these talks? And he said, don't worry about it. If you don't have it, you don't have it. So there's a bit of a pressure always when you start talking like this. But it seems to be that the mind wants to talk about inspiration. And it's a bit of a normal topic for me. So I'm sure you heard. Don't go back to my talks. All my talks are like this. But so just take it as it is. Inspiration is... it's one of the things what keeps you on the path. It's one of the key ingredients to keep you going as a Buddhist, as a meditator. If you don't have inspiration, if you don't have something which uplifts your mind, then you get depressed. You start drifting away. You forget the meaning of why are we practicing. And practice, sometimes we use these words like practice, and like, what does it mean to practice? It's different things, perhaps, and different times. It's a different day, even different part of the day means different things. But the key thing about practice really means that in a Buddhist sense, if you go like that, it's to be on the path of having the Eightfold Path, to really follow the path, the Eightfold Path. And obviously the end result should be, or is, fading away, getting out of this wheel of samsara. That's the end result. So we meditate to really to end the suffering, and this path should be a happy path. I was teaching in Finland a month ago. I did a retreat in during the Easter time. We did a long weekend retreat, and I had translated this little booklet called Word of the Buddha. It's a very nice booklet, and it's I think the first one. They combined Buddha's teaching into this small booklet, and it was first done 1912, 1913, something like that. Like really long time ago. It was done by a German scholastic monk, Vinobunyana Tiloka, and he did it. He was an amazing translator. His biography is just amazing read, how he was inspired to leave from Germany. This was even before the First World War. I mean, there was like, where did he find the Dhamma? What got he into the path? And for him to even to end up in Sri Lanka in those days, it was a massive undertaking. Like, it wasn't just no airplanes, obviously, and there's no steamships, I think, weren't really. They were even still sailing some of the parts of the voyage, and he went through many places. He actually started to try to find the Dhamma, the Buddha's teachings. He went to China, he went to Japan, many places, and he ended up in Sri Lanka and ended up ordaining there. So he's one of the first really Western monks ordained. There were a few ones. There was an Irish monk ordained perhaps before him. He was an English monk, I think, in early days. Both of them, they were in India and then end up in Burma, I think, and they were ordained. So in those days, it was like if you weren't in Southeast Asia or perhaps in China, Japan, you wouldn't have come across the Dhamma. But for him, like Vinobunyana Tiloka, when he heard the teachings and they started to get these trickles, I can't remember from top of my head now, like where did he hear it? But there was an interest definitely in arts and in music and many things. They got the interest from Asia. So they were like, if you look at the arts from 1910 and 20s and all that, it was quite influenced by the East, from Japan and China and all those things. And also obviously they got the information from India, from East India companies to England, obviously. But anyways, going back to that, the inspiration that even for him, once he heard the teachings, he was so inspired that he left his life back in Germany and just went towards something unknown. And it's a little bit same for us. Perhaps you were born in the Buddhist family or you in a Buddhist culture, but then even for us, when we're going towards towards the Nibbana, we're going towards a territory which is unknown for us. We can read it in the books. We can speculate what it means to disappear slowly, slowly. But until you experience it yourself, you really don't know what you're doing. We are all stepping in the darkness until you get there. That's why we need to have strong. Quite often, I find that the people who become monastic, whether it's monks or nuns, we are quite brave in the sense that we are willing to leave behind the world. In a sense that's quite often, even I meet monks and nuns, and they're quite individualistic because there needs to be some quite a strong identity in that you can practice by yourself. And for all of us, whether it's monks and nuns or the for youth, as a layperson, you need to practice by yourself, and you need to. The work has to be done by you. You get the inspiration from the good teachers, and they can describe you the map of the road you need to walk, the Eightfold Path. This is the direction you need to be walking towards. But until you really start getting into the deep meditation, you are practically walking blind. You have enough faith to keep going, but faith alone doesn't take you there. And that's where we differ really from other religions, that we cannot just operate on faith alone. It is, faith gives a really, I like that. In the beginning I was quite skeptical about the faith thing and all that, but it gives a lot of sweetness into the practice. So it's a good to have it and good to trust when the teachings are over and over again, say about you should practice loving kindness, metta, you should practice giving, have a heart which is always giving, have a heart which is always willing to let go. You really practice out of faith, you do that out of faith. And it gives this kind of sweetness into the practice. I've been in seeing different traditions where, especially in this kind of modern Vipassana tradition perhaps, or just mindfulness practices where they tend to strip everything out of that and let, we just meditate, we just sit quietly, and that's good enough. It tends not to, there's a tendency of having it's a bit of a dry grind. It doesn't have that kind of sweetness element into it, which we need to have in order to go forward in the path, in order for us to keep going until we die. And then that will hopefully, that karma of that kind of sweetness will follow you to the next lifetime. And it will. That's what the teachings tell us. So we need to have an element of faith. But the key thing about this practice is, like I said, somebody inspires you and 2 days later it's out of the window. There's a remnant there. So there's something, oh yeah, I remember Ajahn Brahm said something. It was very inspiring. But 2 days later, you really don't remember that much out of that. I hope I'm not the only one. Maybe everybody else. No, it's not just me. It happens to all of you. It happens, the tendency is there that the life takes over. Your normal way of mode of thinking just kicks in and you become uninspired again. If you can keep it 2 days, good. Half a day is probably the more normal. So after this, I try to inspire you as best as you can. And, you know, this is actually, I always say that I like to give talks like this because it inspires me. It keeps me on the practice. So that's why I don't mind teaching. Obviously, there's a limit how much we can give. But once in a while, when I come here and I see you all, and it really is part of the reason why I'm a monk. It keeps me on the, it keeps me inspired. But so what is that? What are we missing there? Like after 2 days, why do you go back into that old self? Why do you go back into listening that nagging voice of that third person almost speaking in your mind and doubting? For me, my mind has a lot of doubt. Some people have, I don't know what the modus operandi is there in their mind there. Perhaps they have a lot of guilt. Some people have a lot of anger. Maybe some people have these. There's this basic things in your mind, which is there seems to be this nagging thought in your head where there's like a third person talking in there. Why do we always follow into those things? That I don't know, actually. Interesting. Like, I'm asking questions, but I don't have answers for this. I have the same thoughts in my mind. I can see them. And the more I meditate, it's not that I just see them more clearly, which is really difficult sometimes to watch at them, but the more I meditate, more if the practice is, for example, now we talk about meditation, that's the practice. The more I meditate, I see it more clearly, but the more I spend time by myself and being able to watch it, it becomes a little bit less. The doubting mind, which is my my third person talking to, like, why are you what are you doing there? Is anybody listening to you? Why, you know, who are you to talk to these people? All those things. I can see it in the beginning quite clearly. Like, when Ajahn Brahm is there, you're very inspired. It's easy to practice for a while. You don't have to worry about so much. It's almost like this carefree honeymoon period. But then I have to sort of go back to the grind by myself. And as a monk, we live by ourselves in the forest, in a small hut, try to spend as much as time by ourselves as possible, not get distracted. Imagine if you just can't be distracted that much. You see that thing all the time. It gets pretty tiring after a while. And the only thing you can do is, there's a couple things you can do, actually. You have to have enough patience to realize that this mode will slowly start fading away. If you spend enough time of meditating, of being quiet, being mindful about it, it tends to slow down, it tends to lessen. But the best thing in the day-to-day life, when we try to remind everybody, have loving kindness, and it sounds a very lofty idea, metta, it sounds this kind of like, well, I can't do it, I don't feel it. It's the most common thing people tell us. I don't feel the metta. No, you have to put the practice in. You have to put the effort in to see that little person in your mind who's talking to you and giving you, you know, doubting or being angry at all the time or having whatever you have, the main thing there. And you need to give it a little bit of sugar. You need to give it a little bit of kindness to that person on that day to day. The inspiration takes you only so far, but the practice is the day-to-day practice where you keep adding kindness towards yourself. That really is the hard yards, the hard yucca, as we say in Australia. That is your work. And then it continues, obviously, when you're sitting down on the cushion. But if you don't, if you live your life unmindfully, you buy into that little person giving you life instructions all the time, and you are in constant fight with it, go with it, and then you sit down, it tends to just keep spinning that same thing. It just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning, and it never almost fade away. But if you are adding it once in a while, remember, that's what we call sometimes we use the Pali word sati. It is almost like a memory. We remember the teachings. Oh, yep, I'm too much in my head. And you see that wild galloping thoughts and thinking, overthinking all the time. Once in a while, remember, okay, no, I should be more mindful. I should just add kindness into this. So either have kindness towards those thoughts, really like, okay, yeah, I can see you. I can hear those thoughts. I can see myself talking to myself. I can see myself doubting. I can see myself being angry at others. You don't need to start let's say for anger, you don't need to have loving kindness towards the person. It's quite difficult if you're really angry at somebody. The best thing is to have loving kindness, softness, sweetness, whatever you want to call it, whatever makes the feeling less towards yourself. You see that anger, frustration, doubt in your own mind. It's not really the other person's fault. It's not the society's fault. It's not wherever it happens outside. We always tend, it's very easy to blame others. It's very easy to blame the situation we're in. But the work is really have to be done inside of your own mind. And the work is the foundational work in to be in the Eightfold Path is to have the mindfulness of being kind. Really kind towards self, not hurting yourself, not hurting anybody outside, and then you don't hurt us. It is hard, sure. It's the same way people say meditation is hard. Meditation is not hard when you get there. Until then, you're stepping in darkness. Until then, you're going in faith. Until then, you're just sort of like, I'm just meditating and I just have these looping thoughts all the time and not going anywhere and it's always the same. Until the penny drops. Then it's easy to meditate. And when you're in your own thoughts, if you get sucked into that movie line, when you're in the movies and you're watching it and you are part of that emotional movie line, you get sucked into that, you're watching with TV or you actually go to the movies and you're sucked into that plot. You sort of lose yourself into it and you feel the emotions. The music adds into the sadness and the love and all that. When you're sucked into that, then there's nothing you can do about it. But if you have a little bit of distance into that from that movie line of your own life, it's easier. If you have complete distance, once the movie line disappears, then the meditation is easy. And we have, that's why when you ask somebody like Ajahn Brahm, you said, do you think a lot? He can honestly say that no, he's not thinking. For the thinking is it a problem or is it, we all the time, we're having this speculative mind. We tend to have mind which is not very kind as a default state. But if you keep at it, every moment counts. Remember the basic teaching is having a mind which is at ease. Mind which is content. You can always add contentment in your life. Then it's easy. And that is the happy path. We're not here to make ourselves somehow restricting ourselves, then let's say if we take the precepts or we're meditating, we're like restricting ourselves now for half an hour sitting here and don't move. And that makes you a better person. It doesn't really. It's almost like it shows you what's happening there, that meditation. The precepts are there to help you so you don't have that much doubt in your mind. You don't have to worry about too much. I haven't lied. I haven't abused others. all those things, it helps you. It should be as a tool to give easiness to yourself and others. And that then that sweetness in your mind should give you the ease, the contentment to be on that present moment. If you don't want to be in the moment, if you don't want to sit quietly somewhere, it's not that it's your mind's fault. We tend to have this fault-finding mind of our own mind. It's interesting. It's not the mind's fault per se. You just haven't been mindful enough. You haven't done the hard yakka, being kind. That's the work, really. That is the work we have to do. Until then, unfortunately, we are walking in darkness. We are helped by our teacher's inspiration here to there for a day and a half. But after that, it falls on to yourself. The Buddha said when he was dying, rely on yourself, be an island to yourself. Follow this path and you will come to an end of suffering. So if the suffering doesn't get less and less, there's nothing wrong about the teachings. You just haven't applied yourself enough. If you have same suffering all the time and you've been meditating for years, it's not my fault. It's not anybody else's fault. It's not the society's fault. It's not your parents' fault. It's not your children's fault. It's not the work's fault. It's your own fault. But don't get too fault-finding yourself. I mean, the tendency is that we, if anything, we tend to be most critical of our own minds. And I can see very clearly, having spent a lot of time by myself, and that I don't actually try to find fault from anywhere else outside. Perhaps it's easy for me being a monastery and being able to spend a lot of time by myself. But I can, like I said from the beginning, I can clearly see that the biggest problem is that I haven't been able to relate kindly enough with my own mind. We have very technical, we have a lot of technical teachings and they have to be there. We don't explain everything in the suttas, or Buddha didn't explain everything in the suttas. There's a lot of, even this week I was talking with Ajahn Nisarana, we were talking about something like, where is the karma stored? Do we have any kind of teachings where karma is stored? And that came up, started to think about that, because what follows you from life to life? Let's say it's almost like your mind sort of follows, but the mind is not like a single thing. It cannot be. There's no one single entity of mind. In Buddhism, we don't have a thing called soul. But something that we always say, that the karma will follow you, your kamma, what you've done, your mind state, your effort of being having a lot of kindness, that will tend to follow from life to life. Where is the karma stored? Did Buddha ever thought about, you know, where is the kamma stored? No, he didn't actually, unfortunately. Buddha wasn't very technical like that. Other traditions put a lot of effort. It just reminded me yesterday, because I went to the Bendigo Stupa, the Tibetans have teachings about that. They almost have like this idea that it's almost like a vessel where the karma is stored. But in the suttas, we don't really find it anywhere where Buddha explained things like that. Buddha was quite practical, very practical about the teachings. These later traditions tend to want to explain everything. What goes from life to life? Where is the karma stored? All those things. But as far as we, as a Theravada tradition, as to what we find in the suttas, the Buddha didn't seem to having to explain everything. The Buddha wanted to keep things practical. It has to be, the practice has to be the key thing here. By wisdom alone, okay, and let's say it's more like a book wisdom, by this kind of knowledge, rather, is a better word, by knowledge alone, will really doesn't take you that far. There is a tendency of start thinking that if you understand the path from the books, you read it, you understand the terms, you speculate what it means, that by that you get to the end of the end of the path, and you even progress in the path. Can you see that somebody would read descriptions of the Buddha's the teachings? Dependent origination, and you read it like a manual, like how to operate the microwave. In that sense, you know, like how uninspiring that would be. You read it as like a technical manual. Would you see that somebody would be inspiration for you to break through from this cycle of rebirth? You would technically perhaps understand how it works, but it's missing that kind of sweetness and kindness. It's missing the inspiration from your practice. You won't have it as a day-to-day fallback mechanism. When this afternoon, 3 o'clock, you're back in your home and bam, nothing that I told you reminds you, you remember that. Nothing of the suttas come to your mind. But you have to have enough enough in your mind to remember. Hang on, now I remember now, I should be more kind towards that depressed, doubting, angry, despair mind. That, remember that, that is the practice. Everything else will follow from that. You don't have to trust me, but you have to do it yourself. And I feel I'm starting to repeat myself, so I go for the Q&A now. So that was the talk. Thank you.
Another talk on inspiration.
Don't say that. Yeah, it seems to be my topic of all the time. Anyways.
Thank you, Ajahn. Very inspiring.
That's good. Thank you.
I had a quick question on...
Maybe be closer to the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
So yeah. Just yeah. The people online here.
I had a quick question on what you mentioned about the Buddha saying how, teaching us to be an island unto ourselves. I was wondering if you could help me understand how that also fits in with his teachings on, spiritual friendship being the whole of the spiritual path. Yeah, yeah. Mm. If you could just expand on that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. Good. Great question. And it's, again, another thing where the Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, good friendship, good friend, kind friend, precious friend, however you want to translate that, it's a whole like the Buddha said, it's the whole practice, not just half of the practice, it's the whole practice, it's the good friendship. And in that sense, it is. It is so important, like in that sutta where the monks were having, even these monks, three monks, living together, and then Buddha went to talk to them and said, like, how do you practice? And he said, you know, we go to Pindapat, then we meditate by ourselves, and then evenings quite often we come to and talk about the Dhamma. They were inspiring each other in that sense. And in that went it's interesting, like it's not half of the spiritual path, it's the totality of the, or whole as the, I'm not sure whether that's a good question. I should clarify that with Ajahn Pramali or Ajahn Brahm. Does it mean that it makes the practice whole, or does it just did it actually mean that it is the totality of the practice, or is the whole? But it's almost like I sort of tend to think that it makes the practice complete. It makes it as a whole, and it's I think it comes back into the inspiration that it's. To walk the path by yourself is almost in you cannot think that you could keep going week after week after year after year. That walking by yourself, you could read the books. You could just, you know, like, look, you can go Sutta Central, read all the books are there, all the translations are there, easily available. You don't have to come here. You don't have to see anybody else. You can just have a perfect place for yourself, quiet place, meditate, and that's the practice. No, you get lost really easily. You don't see. You can read the manuals, but if you don't know how to interpret them, it's you get lost. But it's the whole of the, you know, the practice, is that really it means that it's the inspiration of seeing others practicing, having the Kalyanamitas around you, and it keeps you going. We really need these kind of places where we just see others who practice and do their best in putting the effort in. I know for myself, coming from a very rural place, that where there is no teachings available, and I really struggled. Like I lost the path for a while before I became a monk. For a while, there was, you try to keep it going, but if the inspiration is not there, like, why did these three monks, who are already very advanced practitioners, I wonder if all of them were fully enlightened by that time, but why did they come together and talk about, discuss the Dhamma? Because it was so inspiring for them. Why did Buddha meditate, for example? Why did Buddha take retreats? Buddha didn't need to meditate anywhere to get jhanas or anything. The Buddha meditated because he said it's a pleasant abiding. Why did the monks talk about Dhamma? Because it was so inspiring to talk about Dhamma. There's many places and suttas where somebody's sick, for example, and then the other monks, they go and remind them about the teachings for these monks, and they get out of their sickness, or they get very inspired about them, and the sickness alleviates, it's not so bad anymore, or they get healthy. If you see, even if you talk to Ajahn Brahm and there's this day-to-day, most of the stuff we talk about is how to run monasteries and how we should be dealing day-to-day problems, and it's just talk. But if you actually ask him deep meditation, I got deep meditation, for example, you can see that he looks at you differently. Like there's this gladness come out of it into his mind. It inspires him to see that somebody else is practicing well. And it's actually this week one of the most inspiring things about this previous week for me was that there was an elderly man came to monastery, and I was talking with him, and he described how he few times in his life he had these strange experiences, and there were quite deep meditations. And for me, it's like, wow, that's amazing how he described the nimitta, for example, how it started to grow on him, and he didn't realize what he was and why it was important. And it was just, it's such a beautiful thing. It's difficult to explain sometimes, but it's almost there's this weight to that kind of speech. It's not just speaking out of weather or something, whatever it is in life, paying bills or TV programs, anything, Johnny Depp's, I don't know, the thing, what happened to it. Like, it doesn't have a lot of weight. You know how it feels like, we're just talking about, what happened to Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. But it's like, is it really, it doesn't have that weight behind it. It doesn't feel like, wow, that's amazing. It's just like, we're just talking about nonsense. It's interesting, but it's nonsense. One friend of mine, one monk, said one time he was reading the newspaper in our office in Perth. He was reading the newspaper. He was like, oh, yeah, I know it's nonsense, but it's interesting. But that's how it tends to be. Our lives tends to be like that. But once you get into the deep meditations, it's so inspiring. There's so much weight behind that. And the only thing is, like, when you get there, you realize how that's what's the actual important thing is. And that's why you are island to yourself. Then you can start relying on yourself. Okay. Yes.
Could we take an online question before that, and we'll alternate between them? Okay. All right.
He's committed.
The question about the half of holy life and the entire holy life with respect to that question he asked. When the Buddha gives a sermon, you have to think of to whom he's speaking and about what. This question came when Venerable Ananda, who was only a stream enterer, asked his friendship with Sariputra. Remember Sariputra, who was the embodiment of Dhamma. He's the ultimate of wisdom. So he was referring to Ananda, that for you, association with Venerable Sariputra is not half of it, it's the entire holy life, but that will lead you to entire liberation. Actually, that was the really that's where he said to Ananda, the good friendship is not half of holy life, the entire holy life.
Right.
It's very relevant to.
I don't think it was Sariputta, but anyways, I think it was Ananda was. There were the three others. I don't think Sariputta was living with them.
No. It could have been.
That was
the question. So that is why, for them, it is true, but I don't know if it applies to every situation. Mm-hmm. That's the question. It's a dialogue between friendship between
Sariputta and Ananda. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And the question was? No, I'm just joking. Yeah. Good. Thank you for the clarification. It was really nice. Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Ajahn, we've got three questions online. First question here is from the US. Dear Ajahn, can you share your wisdom as to how to practice metta in daily life? How do you practice it in your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I said, it sounds very lofty, ideal, loving kindness. We chant the Metta Sutta, and it says, like the mother who protects with her life her only child. So it's a very, very, in that sense, we can imagine how such a strong feeling it is when you really practice metta. And obviously, metta, as when it's described in that sense, that it's the Brahma-viharas, the divine abodes, it is a very deep meditative experience. But the day-to-day life, metta, it's almost better way sometimes to describe it as, are you accepting yourself as you are? Adding that kind of softness, as you, the way I practice it, it's almost like I have a little bit of distance from my thinking mind, that I just see it and I remember the teachings, that the only thing I can do is have kindness towards that. It's almost like when you see a friend, you smile at it. But in this sense, it's almost like you're seeing somebody you don't really like, your mind. Quite often we tend to have the mind, which we don't really like our minds. So imagine you're seeing somebody quite often and you really don't really appreciate them that much. But when you actually be kind towards them, they do want to hang out with you. Your almost enemy turns into your friend. Whatever it is that, how you find that way, where if you can just see that yourself, you catch yourself like, oh, I'm questioning my own mind, I'm questioning myself, I'm trying to push it away. Well, however that you can turn that near enemy almost into your friend. For me, it's just sort of, even that first step is almost like you look a step away from, have a little bit of distance from that movie scene where you just have a little distance and I was like, yep, I can see it. That already helps. You're too much in that movie. If you don't have a distance to that, there's not much you can do. You are in the scene. Have a little bit of distance. That already is that's the first step. How to have a little distance? Sometimes because I walk the same, for example, I walk the same path every day from my hut towards the breakfast, where we have the breakfast, we call the Sangha house or the Monks Vihara. I'm thinking, I was like, oh, yeah, what was I supposed to be doing? Not to be thinking. I just feel the movements in my body while I'm walking. I don't need to be overthinking all the time. I can just walk. Try to do one thing at a time. That's good enough. But the thing is, whatever makes you have a little bit of distance to that, bring yourself back to the body or all these different things we teach. Once you have a little bit of distance to that mind, then you can actually, the next step is then you can actually have a little bit of kindness. And then it is that thing where you remember the teachings. Yeah, I should be kind. Whatever that means on that moment, it means smiling at you, like, yep, it's there again. I'm doing it again. Not to worry about it. Just be kind. That is adding just a little bit of sweet water into the fire instead of stoking the fire, making it hotter and hotter. It's difficult to talk about sometimes these mind states, but if you do the practice, if you apply yourself a little bit, you start seeing that it's what's in the mind. So don't be curious about your mind. That's, I think, it's a good way of looking at it sometimes. I heard it sometime that actually be curious what's happening in your own mind. That is a good starting point. Quite often we don't want to have that distance into our own minds. Quite often we live, this is me, this is who I am, this is, and you don't realize, no, it's just cause and conditions, just things changing all the time. What's actually happening there? You're not. Curiosity is a nice way of thinking about it, because it's somehow easy thing to, instead of just sometimes we say like, well, I should be actively being kind and all that, you're almost you doing things. But if curiosity is a nice way of thinking about it, then it's somehow easier. Yeah. I don't know if I explained it very good, but anyways, so what's the next question?
Okay. This one here is, it's an assumption, but validation, asking a question. I assume meditation allows one to dip into the underlying issues carried in the collective unconscious, uncover the underlying issues, and the mind frees itself from the bind.
We have to be very careful in Buddhism that we don't start thinking about that there is some kind of underlying consciousness which we don't see, as if there's a stream of consciousness somewhere, like sometimes people say, that we can dip into it, or there is almost like a individual in ourselves which cannot change, or there's a soul. Whatever these things sometimes you hear, and I'm always very, very careful that, look, remember, there's no you there. There is no individual which is constantly the change, never changing, all the time there. This is who I am, and I cannot change it. My character is this. There is no anywhere in the suttas. The Buddha never taught a mind which you cannot access, mind which is not just like Freudian idea of this, like it, which is you cannot access, and that sort of like has these ways of making us behave in certain ways. It doesn't exist. The more you look into your mind, you realize I'm just reacting into cause and conditions all the time. You perhaps not be able to see those the causes which create the conditions. You might not be able to, and it's not like we need to find them either. It's not like you can see them after a deep meditation. Until then, really don't try to find that there will be, it's because of this I'm behaving this way and I'm now trying to, don't try to solve problems. You just get more deep into the problems. This is not what we're doing. We don't try to make ourselves into better people. This is not a self-help program. Again, another one which I'm really against. This is not like we give you, somehow make you a better person. This will be solving your problems. As a human, you got born as a human, you will have problems. And you won't become smarter by that you will be able to evade problems. It just won't happen. Don't think you're going to be a smart person. Now I became a Buddhist, I'm a meditator. Problems solved. No. Problems will always come and they will always change. And think, what can you do? Kindness. You don't really solve your problems in that sense that it was like then there won't be any more problems coming. But you know how to relate to them better. Change your perception. That's the only thing you can do. Was one more?
Good morning, Ajahn.
Good morning.
Thanks for your coming here today. Mm-hmm. And thanks for your talk as well. On the last point, which basically you were saying that regarding the self thing.
Self, sorry.
Like a self exists or you there, something like
right,
that.
Right, right, yeah.
Basically, since before my saying something, a disclaimer, because it can be interpreted in a wrong way.
Yeah.
So it's something like, in the disclaimer, some information regarding myself, like, I am from a Hindu family.
Mm-hmm.
Started studying about Buddhism few years back only, so don't have much knowledge on Buddhism. But as far as I have read or not read, even heard in some of the videos, basically which were relating to some suttas in a way, and I haven't read much suttas, and even some of the Dhamma talks which I have heard from some other teachers, some other ajans, one of the teachers explicitly said that when the Buddha was asked the question regarding is there a self, he did not answer. When he was asked is there no self, he did not answer. So basically that particular question, whether there is a self or there is no self, he did not answer that question. That teaching regarding sabbe dhamma anatta, the translation of anatta as no self is slightly misleading as for some teachers. It should be better translated as not mine. So something like sabbe dhamma anatta is translated as all phenomena are not mine. Buddha did not answer that question like whether there is a self or there is no self, because either of them will lead someone into a thicket of views as per as what I've heard in the talks. Now, that teacher as well said that if you say that there, just to add to his point regarding why he is saying that the Buddha didn't said that there is no self also, because if you see the teachings on mindfulness of breath, like Satipatthana Sutta, it always says that ever mindful one breathes in, ever mindful one breathes out. There is a body, one knows that. One abides independent, everything, there is a one always there. Something like five recollections, karma is there. We are the owner of our actions. Mm-hmm. You are the owner of your actions and you will you will be the successor of your actions results. There is a you there, that you are the owner of your actions. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it says something like, ever mindful, one breathes in, and when you know, you are breathing in. Whatever body posture you are, mindfulness of body, one knows that one is standing, walking, sitting, lying, talking. One knows that. Mm-hmm. There is always something like, there is reference to a self like, yeah, there is somebody. Again, not like there is a existing thing like a soul or something, but still, as far as the translations goes, it says that, yeah, there is something there.
No.
And moreover, there is one sutta, like, what was the name of the sutta? Yeah, Anantapindika Sutta, like the sutta which I think Sariputra gave to Anantapindika on his deathbed. In that it said, one abides thus, there will be no consciousness of mind dependent on any of those things. Like there are multiple things like, I think, five senses, five faculties, four noble truths, basically all the things it says, and says that there will be, every time it says in the end, I should not cling any to this, anything to, related to this world, nothing related to that world, in any other worlds. So there will be no consciousness of mind dependent on any of these things. So every time that particular statement is ending with that, there is no consciousness of mind dependent on any of these things. Even the five aggregates, the statement is something like, one abides thus, not dependent on form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, and there will be no consciousness of mind dependent on any of these things.
Okay. Let's go to the question part now.
The question part is it not, we haven't reached the stream entry level, is it not valid enough to have a sense of self? Because anyways, we are the owner of our actions, right?
Right. Okay. Thank you. To whether the Buddha did the Buddha say nothing when somebody said there is self or there's no self? No, the Buddha said no. He said no, you're going to two extremes. That's what he actually did say. He said that's an extreme. To think that there's no self, that's one extreme. To say there's a self, that's one extreme. The Buddha teaches cause and conditions, dependent origination.
But so, he didn't say no self explicitly also.
Well, however you want to, like, look, I think that we are beyond the scale, means and scales and the time to explain it here, but if you listen, I would say recommend to listen Ajahn Brahmali's Dependent Origination course, which is like 9 weeks he was teaching Dependent Origination. I was with Venerable Sunyo in BSWA website, so then you get a better understanding of that. Like I said, he goes like I think it was 6 weeks or 9 weeks. It was a really long course. And he's got a small booklet about dependent origination. And he clearly says, you know, I'm making this very, very, very short this time, but look, there is no self, because everything depends on the cause and conditions at that every single moment, whether it's your eye consciousness or any of the five faculties, your five, you know, senses, or the sixth sense, your mind. Nothing is there like permanently available at any moment. It's just constant changing. So how can you say that there's self somewhere in that change, in that every, your mind, let's say you're seeing one point, and then your seeing is you, and is changing all the time. You cannot say that there is in that change somewhere there is self there.
Agreed. Dependent origination explicitly confirms this
but
point.
So you're just going, just to say that there is no self, it would be an extreme to say there's no self. Of course, we have to, going into your question, we live our day-to-day life as if there was self. You cannot be beyond that until you have a deep meditation, and after that for a while, but it tends to kick in. The sense of self is there. But then you realize that we are made out of those different streams. Your body, for example, is made out of different things, and you interpret yourself through those senses. It's difficult to see your mind, it doesn't belong to you. But the Buddha actually said that to actually take, it would be better for you to take your body as you than your mind as you, because your mind is changing constantly. It's so quick. If you start looking at your mind, you start seeing how it's constantly, constantly changing. Not just like your body changes slowly, slowly. But your mind is in constant flux of things happening all the time. And once you start looking at it, you realize it cannot be self. All of that thing what's happening in your own mind cannot be self, because it's so quickly and it's changing all the time. So that to say that there is self somewhere there, it is an extreme. But to say that, no, this is not self, all those streams combine something which you interpret as yourself. But yeah, sure, it is complex, and there's no, we don't say this is how it is, or this is, there is no self. No, it's a really, yeah, it's a difficult one to say.
Thank you.
But yeah, it's a good question, thanks. Chinta.
Just a comment. I think it's the body that people keep on, you know, referring to as self.
No, I don't think so. I think most people think that your mind is yourself. At least I...
The
body and mind is interconnected, but we associate ourselves with our minds all the time. We're sort of outside of our bodies most of the time. Most of the time, the body is almost like it's there. It's almost like a vehicle. We're using it, and perhaps we're worried about it getting old and sick and those things. But the most of the time, you actually are just, you're living in this dream world of your mind, and you interpret that as you. This is who I am. But once you start seeing, it's so chaotic. It's like there's nothing you can do about it. That's the interesting thing about it. Once you start meditating and being mindful, it's almost like there's, it's not just almost. If your mind would belong to you, you could say, if you're angry, if you're sad, if you're depressed, okay, that's it. I don't want to be depressed anymore. I don't want to doubt. I don't want to be angry. And it would just stop. But it doesn't. There's nothing you can do about it.
I like your comparison, actually, of a dream. Because I guess when you think, like, when we get caught up in whether or not we have a self, like, I had a dream, but that, it doesn't mean that the dream is not a fabrication.
Right. Yeah, no, in that sense, yeah, exactly. You said, I just repeat, so we have it in the microphone, that it's, you said that you like the idea that it's almost like a dream, and you start seeing, really, when you have meditating and you're being mindful, and you're seeing that dream or movie, whatever you would call it, it's, we're living in this dream world, and we interpret that as me. and it as it belongs to you, and it's constantly, that it's always there, and it's never changing. But it's actually, the Buddha said, yeah, no, that mind which you're seeing, even this, it cannot be self, because it's constantly changing, it's constantly different. Your body, we actually, if you just look at the body, it seems to be quite similar day to day. Whereas mind is not. Mind is all the time different. One more question online, I think.
There is, okay. We've got just a couple of minutes here. It says, thank you for your inspiring talk, Ajahn. How do you deal with people who lie and manipulate others with their lies?
Again, these questions come all the time, not to diminish the question, but I don't know why we always get these questions about other people manipulating you, and other people are like, I'm in a relationship where the other person is abusing me, or there's like, I have to deal with person who's doesn't seem to have guilt, and they're just making me do things. These questions, in many different ways, they come all the time. But how to deal with those kind of people? Well, look, they're not, remind yourself once in a while and you forget, but you just come, you know, listen to the teachings all the time. I would say it's a good starting point, but it's not these people's fault either. Their behavior is cause and conditions as well. There's nothing you can really, the only way to deal with that is to just to, sometimes you need to have, you remove yourself from the situation. For example, you're dealing with this kind of person, and it's you realize it's not good for you. Well, try to remove yourself from the situation as much as you can. If you cannot, try to have kindness towards that person. If you cannot have kindness towards that person, even a little bit, like you see that, you just go, the Buddha had that example of like, there's like a cow's foot hoof print, and there's a little bit of water. Well, you get on your hands and knees and try to drink that clear water from that hoof print of just, because you're thirsty, you need to drink that, even that little bit of water. There's always a little bit of clear water there. Just see that, even the slightest bit of goodness in that person. So you always try to go better and better. So if you cannot, and if you can't even see the slightest goodness in that person, well, then think that even this postured will have to endure their own karmic results themselves. And then they will have to reap the karma they have created themselves. But the best thing is to just like actually just to concentrate, even the, have they said anything good with their speech? Have they done, okay, they don't, even the speech is, there's nothing good about their speech. Have they done anything good with their body? Okay, their bodily behavior is not good. Is there anything I can relate that there's some goodness in their mind? Just see something there. There's always something good. Just get on your hands and knees and try to find the clear water, even from that the hoof print of that cow, and try to drink that water, that clear water. If you can't even see that, well, then I don't know. Then leave that person behind. Let them be taking care of their own karma. But if you get angry, you're the one who loses. And it's not the outside world which makes us. The outside world. We're somehow making it better. We cannot change ourselves. We can't. So you realize you cannot even change the outside world. But the only thing you can change is yourself. That's it. Sadhusen. Thank you so much. It was so nice to see everybody. Thank you for the questions. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks, I think, again. Thank you.